Can't wait to get on the road again.
This is Ann Dalton for Are We There Yet? Today, I want to begin by covering the last stretch of my African adventure by talking about my visit to Cape Town and other more urban areas. So I'll start with leaving the bush and heading into the city. We spent our last days before heading into the city, staying at the Shekowe Resort. On our way there, we stopped at a woodcarver's colony. They did some amazing work with what they called leadwood. Once in Cape Town, we took a gondola ride to the top of the Table Mountain, where we could see all of Cape Town. We arrived at a resort hotel, which was lovely, with a swimming pool, a nice bar, and lectures on various aspects of African life. It wasn't a total ending to spotting wildlife. As I was shown to my room, I soon had a welcoming committee of mongoose close behind me. I was glad I remembered to close my door, which was sliding glass, because I soon saw a pileup of mongoose craning their little necks to see what was going on inside. Once in Cape Town, we checked into a hotel and took a gondola ride to the top of Table Mountain. We went on to the Cape Peninsula itself along the coast road, and saw the Atlantic Ocean crashing against the tall cliffs on the shore. Cape Town spread out before us. We went on to Cape Peninsula itself along the coast road and saw the Atlantic Ocean crashing in great waves against the tall cliffs on the shore. Although the baboons we'd seen in the bush seemed pretty mellow and family-oriented, we ran into a baboon guard on the road and found out that baboons in this area were very aggressive and unintimidated by human homeowners down the hills from their dwelling places. A sign along the road warned, "Baboons are dangerous wild animals. Do not feed them. Keep doors and windows locked." Amazingly, the baboons in this part of Africa were very clever, feeding their young offspring through partially open windows in the neighborhood below to gain entrance, undo the locks, and let other family members in. The problems had gotten so bad that a corps of baboon guards had to be created to patrol the road above and fend off the baboons with paint guns. As we stood talking with the guard, we saw four baboons creeping down the hill behind him. He quickly excused himself and got back to work. The Stellenbosch University Gardens were beautiful, with a vast variety of plants, flowers, and sculptures. This garden supports research and training at the Stellenbosch University. The university has an increasingly strong focus on species on the brink of extinction. Another thing we enjoyed was hanging out at the wharf in Cape Town, which was within walking distance of our hotel. One day there was a band making beautiful music. The man playing the marimba humored me when I asked to borrow the mallets and do my own solo, never having played the marimba before. Fortunately, the rest of the band drowned me out. We walked the streets of Cape Town, winding through its vibrant street market, which covered an entire city block, as well as the Slavery Museum. The pride with which the vendors in the market showed their ware was evident. There was a variety of goods, including painting, weaving, metalworking, and so on. A late afternoon treat was stopping along the False Bay coastline to see the penguins. These were warm weather penguins, each about 3 feet tall. They were absolutely adorable, with their white chests outlined in black, looking for all the world like gentlemen in tuxedos rocking along the beach. They enjoy surfing and hanging out together. An interesting story about this particular beach in which the animals actually won a major legal battle with the humans was shared. Apparently, several years ago, the penguins' main colonies were limited to the tall rocks along the beach. Due to the large number and length of their stay, the rocks were covered with white penguin doo-doo. At some point, people realized this could be harvested and used this to make fertilizer, and harvest it they did. Unfortunately, this caused the penguins to take up residence on the beach instead. When the townspeople wanted the birds removed, a judge denied the request and was quoted as saying, "You ruined their habitat. You'll just have to let them have the beach." I kid you not. One of the most memorable day trips we went on was to Robben Island, 6 miles north of Cape Town in the Western Cape Province. This is where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned for 18 years of his life. On the boat over, there was a poster with a Mandela quote that read, "It is said that no one truly knows a nation until he has been inside its jails." From the mid-1960s to 1991, Robben Island served as South Africa's maximum security prison. Most of the prisoners were black men jailed for political offenses, as Mandela was. It is now a World Heritage Site. The tour guide there had been an inmate himself for 7 years as a young man. His presentation was both graphic and passionate. It was a pretty rough place, although it had been cleaned up significantly since becoming a tourist attraction. Stories were told of windows with no glass open to the winter winds, bare threaded felt mats used as bed mattresses, and many other hardships. We also came across a street with houses colorfully painted in all colors of the rainbow, housing several artists' galleries. I stopped to interview an artist whose name was Anthony de Klerk, who painted not only African animals, stunning portraits of, as he described it, dreamers and heroes, young black people who have come up through difficult times and dream of a better South Africa. He said it's an ongoing series. And finally, we went to Victoria Falls. As I mentioned in the last broadcast, COVID spelled economic trouble from 2020 through 2021. This realization came home to me the evening we were welcomed to a family's house for dinner during our stay in Victoria Falls. We heard about the tough years endured during COVID, which drastically affected jobs, as it did in America. But in this African country, there were not government subsidies to assist people in making it through those years. Us American tourists were a sight for sore eyes that year. The three-generation household served 10 different dishes for dinner and gave us a fond farewell when the evening was over. Victoria Falls, some natives call Thundering Smoke, is a waterfall in the Zambezi River, which provides a habitat for several unique species of plants and animals. It is located on the border between Zambia and Zimbabwe and is classified as the largest sheet of falling water in the world based on its combined width and height. They are roughly twice the height of North America's Niagara Falls and well over twice its width. We walked along a path listening to the thundering of the falls and were coated in the hanging mist. We enjoyed the rainbows rising up from the canyon. It was a long-awaited and fascinating trip. We said goodbye to our guide and each other and boarded a plane in Johannesburg to return to the States or go on to the next journey. In retrospect, the trip made me much more aware of life on a totally different continent. The cooperative relationships between animals, plants, and their environments was endlessly fascinating and left me wanting to learn more. The need to kill or die was just part of everyday existence, with the old and the very young being the most vulnerable. The limitless ingenuity of people living in poverty, making the best of what they have and wasting nothing. It was such a contrast to life in America, where the variety of food, clothing, and even education is taken for granted by many, and waste is so common. Overall, the struggle between the economic conflict of humans trying to eke out a living for their families and the collision of those efforts on wildlife habitat space and food was clear. The endless demand for the acquisition of sellable goods and trophies from the outside leaves its mark. How to reconcile these forces is the true conundrum of the 21st century. Our next journey and tale is called Mangoes and Machu Picchu. On the way to the famous citadel, roadblocks and delays offer challenges, but also gifts. A connection with strangers, now friends, that this traveler met along the journey. And the article is by Evangeline Young. We are stuck at a roadblock on our way to Machu Picchu, and our taxi driver, Wilbert, is up a tree picking mangoes. "We're screwed," I said. "We'll figure something out," says Brendan, and bites into a mango as if it were an apple. We wait on a strip of tarmac between chartreuse green jungle and sun-browned cordilleras. Protesters with taut faces and anxious eyes cluster around a roadblock of boulders, logs, and branches. The women wear bowler hats and boleros, wide skirts with intricate rainbow trimmings. The men are in baseball caps and football shirts, conferring in Quechua and Spanish. Instead of weapons, they carry hand-painted signs calling for unity and an end to corruption. Watching them, I am split between frustration at the delay and guilt at my sense of entitlement. This is our summer. This is their life. "Quiero uno," Wilbert tosses another mango towards us. I shake my head. I don't understand the lack of urgency, the way time has swelled to a stop, how unfazed everyone is. I'm traveling with Betts, a friend from Melbourne, and two Irish backpackers, Brendan and Brian. We met at a hostel in Cusco, connecting over games of beer pong and conversations covering everything from Spanish imperialism to Ireland's best surf beaches. Brendan and Brian are both engineers, fluent in logic and Spanish. Betts is a data scientist with a contingency plan for every situation. Between them, they have all the common sense and calm that I lack. Our travels in Peru have coincided with the president's arrest, landing us in the middle of nationwide demonstrations, train strikes, and roadblocks. Because of this, we're taking the road less traveled to Machu Picchu, an unofficial taxi down the back roads of Peru's mountainous south. Our plan is simple. Drive 5 hours from Cusco to a power station called Hidroelectrica, the closest you can get to the Incan Citadel by car. Hike 2 hours and stay overnight at Aguas Calientes, the nearest town to Machu Picchu. See Machu Picchu at dawn and drive back to Cusco with plenty of time to spare before Betts and I fly out of Peru. What could possibly go wrong? The shadows are lengthening on the tarmac by the time the protesters clear the roadblock and disperse. Shouting Viva el Perro, the locals join in the chorus, leaning against their car horns and cheering. The noise ricochets through the air, breaking the tension of hours of waiting. We pile into Wilbert's Toyota Aris, a well-loved 2005 model. Wilbert floors the accelerator. In the car, Betts and Brian swaps travel stories, while Wilbert and Brendan canvass politics, history, and sport. Wilbert is well-informed and diplomatic, giving nuanced responses to Brendan's questions. His phone vibrates once a minute. He is part of a WhatsApp group of local taxi drivers who trade insider information about the demonstrations, staying well ahead of the official sources. The terrain gains gravitas, the road curving and contracting as we ascend into the Andes. At 4,000 meters above sea level, we pass through a low-hanging cumulus. Statuesque mountains soar and plunge into sun-drenched plateaus, where the Urubamba River, powered by glacial melt, pounds and pummels its way toward the Amazon. After a few hours, we emerge into the high jungle, humid cloud forests of fern and rhododendron. The sun sets subtly, black curling around blue. Tarmac deteriorates into gravel and dust. We stop for dinner at a restaurant in Santa Teresa, a town half an hour's drive from Hidroelectrica. It's too dark to hike anywhere tonight. I call the airline to reschedule our flights. Wilbert translates. After two hours on hold, we are told that we cannot reschedule. Brian does some quick Googling and discovers that the trains from Aguas Calientes to Cusco are running again. Betts and I can catch the 1 p.m. train tomorrow, arriving back in time for our evening flights. I try to buy tickets online, but my card doesn't work. Neither does Betts. Brendan pays. Brian speaks to the restaurant owner, who recommends a friend's place where we can shower and sleep. He closes the restaurant and walks us over, his flashlight parrying the dark. There is a tense choreography to arriving at a strange house after midnight. We tiptoe around the kittens sleeping on the stairs. A grasshopper sidesteps the shower drain. I jump in and out of the ice-cold water. The bedroom is like a dormitory in a boarding school. 5 beds in a long, sparse room. Brendan's feet hang off the end of the bed. Shoot, he mutters under his breath. This always happens to me. On the other side of Brendan, Wilbert is snoring, worn out by corkscrew roads and curveball questions. Above us, rain thrums on the tin roof, a grounding familiar sound. At 4 the next morning, 5 alarms go off in unison. We stumble into the car, still groggy, Just as the sun begins to rise, we reach Hidroelectrica and begin our hike. I am running on sheer adrenaline and awe. All around us, the Andes unfurl in lush green billows under lightning skies. We walk in silence, listening to the complex rhythms of wind and river, following the contour of train tracks through fragrant groves of cedar and muña. As we approach Aguas Calientes, the first train of the day thunders past. Brendan raises his fist and cheers. Our entry tickets to Machu Picchu give us access to different routes around the site. So we say goodbye where our paths diverge. I think how travel gifts strangers with trust and intimacy of years of friendship. Brendan's credit card details on my phone, the precise cadence of Wilbert's snores in my head. I wonder how Andean ice caps become Amazonian river water, thousands of kilometers south. How five people from three different corners of the world coincide at a singular point in space and time. I think how we will probably never see each other again, and I must say something meaningful, but the words wedge in my throat. We hug, turn, and walk away. Betts and I climb to the top of Machu Picchu, one of the viewpoints above Machu Picchu. The air is warm and viscous like honey. Butterflies drift past, trailing silken wings. Below, terraces and towers of stone rise against mountains crowned with clouds. Betts opens her backpack and hands me a mango, golden ripe, bursting at the seams. I take a bite. Time swells to a stop, but for once, I couldn't care less. Back to the States. Virginia is a northern neck. Virginia is for oyster lovers, said William Fleeson in the Wall Street Journal. The storied state leads the East Coast in oyster production, and at 70 miles long, the northernmost peninsula on the Chesapeake Bay lends itself nicely to impromptu restaurant hopping. This area was literally built on bivalves. During a recent visit, I noticed that many of the old buildings, including Stratford Hall, the plantation home where Robert E. Lee was born, were constructed with a mortar made of ground mollusk shells. Northern neck oysters are prized for their light, creamy taste, and at the Horn Harbor restaurant in Burgess, I dug into a platter of oysters, shrimp, rockfish, and hush puppies, all transformed into crispy delights, says the author. At the Tides Inn, a resort in Irvington, I slurped oysters while watching pastel-clad lawyer types play croquet and followed that with a four-course seafood feast at the Hope and Glory Inn. On my final day, I visited George Washington's birthplace in Colonial Beach, where the site of George's first home will soon be outlined by, what else? Crushed oyster shells. Then we go to Florida's Manassota Key. I don't know how this key is faring with the current hurricane season, but this description is very enticing. The author writes, if your idea of a vacay bliss includes white sand beaches and a low-key vibe, this one's for you, said Diane Baer and Pamela Wright in the Boston Globe. Even some Floridians are unfamiliar with Manassota Key, an 11-mile barrier island between Fort Myers and Sarasota, where, quote, the calm-inducing thrum of waves is a constant and the sunsets are spectacular. Many visitors take day trips to nearby Venice or Bocca Grande, but we were content to keep it beachy because the Minnesota Key Resort was, quote, exactly what we were in the mood for. Our suite faced the Gulf, and our days fell into a happy rhythm of sleeping in, kayaking to secluded islets, swimming, lounging, and eating fried grouper sandwiches at the resort's cafe. We didn't need a rural car, thanks to Stumpy's, a volunteer-staffed service that taxis visitors around in golf carts for free. One evening, we stumpied over to Sandbar Tiki and Grill. This is exactly the kind of place Florida is famous for. Good food, outdoor dining, live music, and a sandy patch where little kids play while the grown-ups sway to 70s classic rock. That's all we have time for this week. Tune in next week and see where we go next. Thought for the day. One small crack does not mean that you are broken. It means that you were put to the test and you didn't fall apart. This quote from Episcopal priest Linda Poindexter, quoted in Good Housekeeping. This is Ann Dalton for Are We There Yet?
Just can't wait to get on the road again.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on broadcast info and audio, then under programming links, left click on demand podcasts. You can now listen to Sunsounds on your Echo Dot or other smartphone devices. This is Ann Dalton signing off on Are We There Yet? Have a great week.